Dr. Alexandria Osborne was working for Pfizer in Kalamazoo when she decided to start a fellowship program for a humanitarian group in Tanzania. Little did she know that she would meet her current husband, move to his rural hometown, and start her own organization dedicated to the health and education of rural Tanzanians. Osborne has written a book about her journey called The Black Mzungu, and she's here with me in the studio to talk about it. Alexandria, thanks so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
So you grew up in New York, then moved to Kalamazoo to work for Pfizer, where you met your first husband, Libyan-American.
Yes.
And you would, you know, frequently go back to Libya with him and, you know,
and visit your daughter and visit them.
Was that kind of your first connection or where you first started to love Africa?
Yes. Well, I do consider North Africa is quite different than Sub-Saharan Africa is what I found. But it was really my first exposure marrying actually a student from Western, you know, who came here to go to school. It was really my first exposure to international travel and the challenges, you know, of that. So I do consider, even though it's all one continent, the culture of North Africa is a bit different than Sub-Saharan Africa, partly due to, you know, the history, the colonial past, and really the geography of that Sahara Desert there.
Right, they're huge, so many miles away.
But it did prepare me quite a bit, you know, for what I experienced. Because there were challenges in that international travel and going to North Africa, and there still are similarities. They're still all Africans.
So after you divorced your first husband, you kind of started thinking about this fellowship. Mm-hmm. You know, what really made you decide, you know, I want to go to Tanzania and I want to do this kind of work?
Okay, so first of all, just a little bit clarification on the introduction. The fellowship program is a Pfizer program.
Right, right.
Right? Mm-hmm. Just for the listeners. It's called a Global Health Fellowship. So, and I was also in the process of doing my my dissertation research almost at that time. And it just, things were just, and my daughter was in the process of getting married. And of course, she's on her own and she's grown. So I think a lot of people in my age group, as a baby boomer, you're in your 50s, you find yourself, you know, wow, you know, so now what? You know, and so I thought this is a perfect opportunity to apply for this program and learn, you know, travel, help people, because the Global Health Fellowship is a great project that Pfizer sponsors to help NGOs around the world, non-government organizations like CARE International, where I worked, organizations like Save the Children, and many, many, many get free expertise from Pfizer, and Pfizer continues to pay your salary and so on. So when I saw that, and there were other people who I had worked with who came back, and they come back different people. So there were people, and I was in IT at the time, and I had worked with people who, like one went to, I think it was at least two went to countries in on the continent of Africa, but you can go anywhere in the world they may send you. So it's a long process of applying, being matched, interviews. So I was just at that point in my life where I said 3 to 6 months, this is maybe a great time, you know, for me to do that. And but I never thought that I would be retiring. I was caught by surprise. The whole idea of the program is that the international experience enriches employees. So they come back and they're better employees. You know, so they really hope that you don't go, you know, because people are doing your job for you when you're gone. It's a sacrifice for your manager, you know, that kind of holding your job while you're doing this. And then for you to come back and say, oh, I'm retiring. That's not the plan. You know, but for me, you know, it was just, it turned out a little bit different. It was just that point in my life, you know, and I think some of what's in the book, there's, may be useful for retirees who are thinking, okay, now what? Can I live, you know, abroad? Do I want to retire in the U.S.? You know, there's economic issues to consider. Many retirees think that they can live a better lifestyle on their pensions abroad than here. But of course, there's sacrifices to doing that too. And that part of that is leaving, you know, your family and loved ones behind.
Yeah. And, you know, it seems like when you first arrived in Tanzania, you were kind of looking for sort of an Islamic community to really connect with. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a part where in the book where you talk about you're driving around and trying to find the right mosque.
Yes.
And you can't really find, you know, a place where you fit in. Some are just too, you know, foreign, and you don't really want to go that way, you know, for foreigners, I guess, or Mzungus.
Yes.
And then, you know, some are just, you know, they don't quite do the prayers that you're used to or that you want.
Right.
You know, do you feel like it was different from what you expected in that way?
Yes. I mean, my experience, first of all, I was very close to the Kalamazoo community. You know, I'm a revert, or we say convert, to Islam. So a lot of my education and so on over the 20-something years that I've been a Muslim has been right here at Kalamazoo Islamic Center, close to Western. You know, so I was used to it that way. And of course, I've been to Libya, and I had also been on Hajj. But
and we should explain, Hajj is a
pilgrimage.
Huge pilgrimage
yes.
to the Holy Land.
Yes. Yeah. And so I had picked my time to the best of my ability, because I'm a big planner and my background is project management. I said, okay, so I'll go during Ramadan, which is the fasting month for Muslims. I'll go 1 week before Ramadan, so my body will adjust to the time change and the environment, and then I can begin fasting in a country that's 40%, about 40% Muslim, 40% Christian. It's a very mixed country. So all this was planned, and I was kind of looking forward to it, and I had really, in Kalamazoo, enjoyed the fellowship at Kalamazoo Islamic Center, where we break the fast together on weekends and so on. You know, I was trying to duplicate that. Well, I found I couldn't duplicate that. Part of it is, you know, my language, where for Swahili is the national language of Tanzania. And the other is those that are English speaking were primarily of Indian descent. And that mosque was not that was a Shiite mosque. You know, so I'm not to get into the sectarian differences, because for me that doesn't make a difference.
But it was just kind of different
culturally.
Practiced.
They were very warm. And the taxi driver, you know, you have a driver when you're there. I didn't drive around. The driver who was looking for a place for me, he thought, because I'm English-speaking and American, I'll take her to the mosque that primarily speaks English. Well, it turned out they practiced a little bit different from me. We're all Muslims, but it was just a little bit different. And then he's charging me, you know, every night if I did this. It was taking a lot. It was very expensive for me. You know, for him, it was income. You know, pick me up, waiting for me to go through the evening services, you know, and then driving me back. I said, oh, this is not sustainable. You know, so after a couple days, not even a week, you know, I realized I'll just, you know, do my spiritual worship, you know, but alone in my apartment, you know. But yeah, so that was like one of the first like culture things, because I arrived right the week before Ramadan.
So I used the word already, but I'm going to say it again. So your book is called The Black Mzungu.
Mm-hmm.
And hopefully I'm pronouncing that correctly, or that I can. I'm not quite sure.
Yeah, let me just say something about the word Mzungu. First of all, I always was pretty lousy in foreign languages. So I really admire people who can pick up a language quickly. And, you know, Swahili is a Bantu, I guess you would say, language, and it has a lot of double consonants.
Consonants, yeah.
Thank you. And those are kind of hard. So example, Mzungus who are not familiar with Swahili or Kiswahili might say Mzungu. You want to make it a syllable, but the M is just so little. Mzungu. It's spelled Mzungu. It's a double consonant. So Mzungu. You know, and I may not even be saying it 100% correct, because I'm, like I said, I've been there 6 years. People say, oh, she doesn't know Swahili yet. They always say to my husband, you know, I mean,
It's a complex language.
Yeah, but it's a little easy compared to some other languages, because number one, there isn't any gender differences in conjugation of verbs. As an example, there's no he, she, you know, so it's a little bit simpler that way. They use the same alphabet as we do. They have a lot of words that they've adapted from English, Arabic, and so on. But I think part of the problem is I have not really assimilated into the society, which is part of being a Mzungu. You know, I live in a village, very rural area, and where I live is pretty isolated. So my day-to-day communication is with my husband. You know, and a lot of people who travel internationally, they may have housekeepers and I hear people learn language that way, you know, from their housekeeper. I choose not to have one. I prefer not to, and I really don't intend to, unless I'm just so ill that, you know, I would need someone to help take care of me. You know, so, so it's Mzungu. You did pretty good, the black Mzungu, which kind of means, people use that to mean foreigner. But when people were calling me Mzungu, I felt a little insulted. And that kind of inspired me to write the book a little, because it was kind of this identity. I was going through a little identity crisis.
Yeah, and the connotation of the word, you know, it just means foreigner, but, you know, many people would kind of say that word in a way to mean, you know, someone who is, I guess, maybe snooty or not integrated or, you know, something like that.
Yeah, like, so it's kind of like to me, it meant I was an outsider. So when a lot of times when African-Americans, which is what I'm considered here, even though I'm fair complected, but I'm considered an African-American and always had been my whole life. And no one ever doubted that. Nobody ever questioned that. And so then, and a lot of African-Americans, they say, you know what? You know, I know that I'm a descendant from a slave. And slaves came from the continent of Africa. And I want to go back, you know, and I want to see what it's like. You know, and I talk a little bit about this in the book, how Alex Haley, he went back, and everybody wants to know their roots, you know, and people nowadays are doing DNA testing. Okay, so that was the difference between what we were talking about earlier, going to North Africa and Sub-Saharan Africa. Going to Sub-Saharan Africa, I remember when I first landed in Libya the first time on the continent, and I did have that feeling, you know, oh, I'm here on the motherland. But going to Sub-Saharan Africa was even different because I know that's where maybe some of my DNA came from. So to be called Mzungu, and when people talk in Swahili or they don't refer me by name, you can hear them say they're Mzungu. You know, I said, my goodness, why are they calling me Mzungu? You know, and even some people, maybe they knew my name, but it was easy for them to refer to me as Mzungu. And I really had trouble with that concept in the beginning. But as time evolved, sometimes I now use it. And if I call somebody, like I have maybe my Bajaji driver in town. So I call him. I say, this is Mama Mzungu. Bajaji is like a rickshaw.
Oh, okay.
Okay, right. A taxi. You know, so I call when I'm in town, you know, I call the same person. You know, so it's just easy to say Mama Mzungu. Or when people are looking for a house, which is in a very isolated area, we say, just say where the Tanzanian lives with the Mzungu, right? So now I'm okay with it. But in the beginning, it was something very difficult for me. I felt that, you know, I wasn't being accepted as the long-lost cousin. And I think a lot of people go through that. And we make an assumption that just because there's common DNA, that there's a tie. But centuries and centuries have gone by where there is still a divide between the African-American descendants of slaves and the African. They are different. You know, they're the same, but they're different. You know, so I think some of that helped me. I tried to put that in the book, that kind of that journey, that feeling of like, where do I belong? You know, I know that in Libya, as an example, I think Arabs have some of the most hospitable people I know. When I arrived in sub-Saharan Africa, you know, I found that people, I didn't get the invitations that I expected. You know, like, oh, come to my house for dinner, come here, come there, right? But when you go to, example, in Libya, or even, you know, other countries that I have been to, like Egypt, Tunisia, and North Africa, you don't have time to go to all the invitations. People are insulted. But I think what it is people are shy, that they can't give you the hospitality that they think, because you're Mzungu, that you would expect.
Right, right. And it's, you know, and sometimes that might be true, yeah, actually, depending on, you know, how the person is faring.
Yes.
You know, in that country, right?
Yeah, but, you know, I found that even in North Africa, there were people who were not well off, but there's a different, you know, I'm happy, whatever you have, whether it's a glass of water or whatever, you know. But I think when I went there, there was that divide between your Mzungu and the local indigenous Tanzanian. You know, so when I arrived at the NGO, I saw this divide between the international staff and between the local staff. There's even different pay scale. So that was something for me, who was used to coming out of corporate America, where we have now gone to flat structures the best we can, not hierarchical structures, you know, to still see, you know, an authoritative hierarchical management style, and then this divide between the international staff and the local staff. So now, as an African American, who was I? Did I belong with the international staff? Right, because I'm American and carry that much desired passport with the blue cover? Or do I fit in more with the local staff because, you know, I'm considered a Black American? Mm-hmm. You know, and so I was like really confused about that. You know, where did I fit with all that? But Mzungu, since we're talking about that word, has evolved to mean a lifestyle. You know, also. So it started out, the word Mzungu, and it's on a website, and I actually had to figure this out myself. Where did this word evolve from? Well, Kazungu Zungu means dizzy. Mm-hmm. I mean, literally, and, you know, so at least I know when I go to the doctor, if I'm dizzy, I can say, if I think I have malaria or something, oh, I'm Kazungu Zungu. So I know that word. And from what I understand, people thought that when first Europeans came to Tanzania, they always got lost. So they went around in circles, oh, right? So the locals said, oh, they go in circles enough to make you get dizzy. So then it became a word to refer to not white Americans, but European or European descent people, right? So that's why I said, why are they calling me Mzungu? I'm Black American. Not that it really matters, you know, but I was confused by why they would call me Mzungu. Then I started to understand that, okay, because my Swahili is not good and I'm a foreigner. Then I hear the word being used as a lifestyle, right? Like, oh, that Mzungu house, you know. So then I learned to joke around with them with time and not to be so sensitive. When I go to the market, I say, wait. Don't give me that Mzungu price. I know that you're trying to rip me off, basically. You know, and they will. You know, I mean, it's a society like many countries around the world where you bargain. Mm-hmm. You know, they say one price, you immediately come back with half of that. You know, right. And Americans aren't used to that. You know, but anyway, so that's kind of where Mzungu comes from. So they call me Mzungu still. Depending on the context, depends on how I take it. You know, but now, you know, I don't feel as insulted in most cases and have a tendency to use it myself kind of jokingly.
Well, it's nice that you have, you know, kind of embraced what what was a insulting word for you at one point, you know, and kind of and turned it around in a way that, you know, you use it in your own way.
Yeah,
you know?
I can remember when I was on a fellowship, which was the first 6 months there, and I mentioned this online somewhere, and it was another fellow, global health fellow. She was in Rwanda, and she was African American, and she said, "No, don't think of it that way." You know, and they use that here also, you know, because Rwanda, they speak Swahili also. And I was like, oh, maybe I'm just oversensitive, you know, when she told me that, you know. So, you know, you can't change the way it is. And so I learned to embrace it, and then I actually use it.
And I think it's worth noting that you are wearing a shirt right now that says Mzungu.
Yeah, so actually, you know, you did ask me, did I have that custom made, and I have... No, it's one of the things you can buy at tourist shops. So that just shows you how the word Mzungu is used, you know, there.
It seems kind of like a clever idea on the part of the, you know, of local Tanzanians to, you know, kind of be like, oh, that's the tourist over there.
I'm a Mzungu,
You know, obviously the big part of this book is the fact that you... left your job, you and Saidi, your husband, both left your jobs to build this farm in Jome. And had you farmed before?
No. You know, I, like you mentioned, I grew up, I was born and raised in New York. And then after I came to work for the then Upjohn Company, you know, which then became Pharmacia and Upjohn, then Pharmacia and then Pfizer. Yeah, I lived in suburbia and tried to do a little gardening here and there, but I wouldn't call it farming. And this, when I first fell in love, I guess you would say, when we decided to get married, which was a surprise to everybody, you know, the decision is, wow, what do we do now? You know, I mean, do you do what many people think you would do? Oh, start applying for green card and come here and move to the States? No, you know. So what happened was, and Sadie was working for the NGO at the time, and yeah, like I talk about in the book, you know, there was a difference between Sadie and I as far as, you know, education and so on. And I think one thing that I tried to explain in the book, you know, I married Sadie for, I mean, he was the most had the most impeccable integrity out of anyone that I had met, but you know, he got had his first pair of shoes when he was 10 years old. And Jome is the name of the farm we live on, but it's in the village of Ruvu. But his father gave it that name when he moved the family there to be closer to the ocean to fish. Okay? And it happened, the government, when they did the survey, it turns out to be 92 acres. And it's a lot of forest. You know, not the farms, not, it doesn't look like farmland like you picture here in our fertile Midwest. You know,
right.
You know,
not,
it has
not
rocks
acres and
forests.
Of flatland. Right.
Right. You know, I mean, even you, when we tried to do sesame one year, you know, there was a lot of stones. You're putting the seeds between, you know, between stones. But anyway, yeah, Sadie, he just said, what do you want to do? It was my choice. Now, I had lived in I was living in Dar es Salaam during the fellowship, which is the capital, commercial capital. Not political capital, but commercial capital, where the port is and where all the embassies are.
Right,
where everybody
where
wants to be.
Happening.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, and then so one weekend he says, okay, I'm going to show you where I was born. Right. So we take this 6-hour drive, and at the time it wasn't all paved, so it was a rough ride. And then we went to the village, and the, wow, you know, that, and it's kind of like off-road, and you can't take a regular car. We actually, he had a regular, like, sedan at the time, and we borrowed somebody's SUV for this trip. And then we slept one night in one of his, somebody's house in the village. They considered it the best house in the village because it had a toilet. Right? What did I think? Okay, that's good. You know, and it did have cement. It wasn't mud. And it wasn't like grass roof. So I slept there. And the next morning, we went to Jome, the farm he grew up on. The homestead, I would say. You know, farm may not be the exact word for us here. And there was no road there. So we had walked 3 kilometers over rocks, past a mangrove forest. We had to take a small dhow to cross this little water passage. And nobody was there. It was this pristine beach. And he showed me the stones where he was born. And he showed me the family cemetery, so I knew they had been there. And they vacated it in 1968 when his father died at the age of, what they say, 114. And Sadie was only 10 years old. And his mother could not stay there, you know, alone with the younger siblings, him being the oldest boy there at the time, at 10. So after what they do, 40 days of mourning, kind of, she stayed there. And then they moved in, the family got a little split up. Okay, so nobody lived there. Just fishermen sometimes had campfire there. Right? And so I said, this is fine. We can live here. Oh, Sadie was so ecstatic. He was like a little boy. And he ran into the ocean and he swam. I never forget that day. And we decided where we would build a little bit further from the house he grew up on, which was close to the ocean. You know, I didn't want water coming in high tide, coming in the front door and going out the back like when he was a boy. And I could see how happy he was. And he said, you know, I never thought that I would ever have the capital or resources to be able to build a house here, but I always wanted to secure this for my family because look at the cemetery. And I saw all these little stones, unmarked graves of old ancestors. I mean, this was really a family village, you know, of extended family. You know, and the village people acknowledged that. When we decided to build there, they just said, yes, this is his land. The owner has come back. So that land was vacated in 1968. Mm-hmm. So basically, the Black Mzungu book, a good part of it is that journey of opening up. Sadie always says it was closed in 1968, and then we came and opened it up. Right? Even when I came back to the States to finish up my life and tie it up kind of nicely, Sadie was there trying to get car access to Jomé. So he hired 50 villagers, and they made a road. Now, you may not call it a road. And what I call a road today, I didn't call a road then. When he first took me by car, he said, okay, be quiet. This is the road, so don't say anything. Now I begin to appreciate what a road is. The road is still pretty rough, you know, and we have to manage it ourselves. We're 18 kilometers away from the nearest paved road. And I'm sorry, I still have to talk. I'm now talking kilometers, so you have to do the conversion yourself.
Well, I'm sure our listeners can do that. That's no problem. But yeah, so, you know, was it how he felt and you know, his real connection to that land that made you think, you know, I need to do this not only for him but myself and move to this compound?
Well, I guess I kind of felt that, you know, like I mentioned before, around 2010, I said, I have a funny feeling this is a year of change. Now, this is before I met him. Okay, I was finishing up my dissertation. I was already in my 29th year at Pfizer, you know, and there was a lot of change in my personal life. And like I said, I was born and raised in New York. I mean, I lived my first 23 years in New York City. And it was kind of like, okay, so why would I want to live in congested Dar es Salaam? I'm not trying to make a living. That's where people are when they're still at a certain part of their life trying to be at the peak of their earning potential, you know, where the jobs are and so on. This is a beach. Who can live on a beach? Shit on a beach, you know? And I said, and I trust this. And from the time, and I think what you'll see, what readers hopefully will capture, especially from the early part of the book, is how much I trusted Sadie from the beginning. You know, it was just something that, you know, I trust him and I felt protected, even though, you know, I learned that I'm still in a hostile environment. You know, but he always, one time my father told Sadie, take care of my daughter. And sometimes he says to me, yeah, I promised your father that I would take care of you and I'm going to take care of you. And sometimes, and I can see that he does that, you know. And so I felt protected. I knew that this was a risk, but I never felt in danger with him, even though a lot of times we were in potentially dangerous situations. I can see he had real smarts. You know, he lived, you know, he lived in Dar es Salaam for years, you know, but he grew up, you know, in this village.
Right. He had that instinct to farm and, you know, and what it's like to live in a more rural area there.
Yeah. I mean, sometimes I'm very surprised by their common. I'm impressed, even though people may not have school education, even though, like, our neighbor in the book who's called Mr. Gazelle, you know, he. For certain things, these are the people that you want around you. Oh, this is a leopard footprints. Oh, look at that python track. Oh, look at this. Oh, do I want somebody, you know, from New York with me? No, I want these guys with me during those times. And I saw that Sadie had, you know, both the both scents. Yet Sadie never made it past primary school because of what happened in his life. You know, he learned English on his own. He was the first one in his family when he went to his father and said, I hear that there's a elementary school. They say primary school. They're in British system. A primary school in the next village. I want to go to school. Right? So that showed you the kind of person he is. Many people, especially back then, didn't even go to school, especially people who lived in such rural, rural environments, you know, living off the land. So I just was kind of ready for, okay, why not? It was that kind of that been there, done that. And I almost had the same feeling of when I was 23 years old and New York was my whole life. And you know how you are at 23, you know, you're very social and, you know, and then I came for an interview in Kalamazoo, Michigan in 1980. The only flights in was Republic by propeller, you know, plane. I mean, Kalamazoo was a lot sleepier than what it is now, right? And I did one of those, okay. I can work for this company Upjohn for 1 year, and if it doesn't work, I can go back. You know, 29 years later, I was still here, and I love the community. But that's the kind of feeling that I had that, okay, I'll try this, you know? And I had somebody with me and a partner with me that I felt that I trusted that I could do this. You know, I did all the rest. Why would I want to be in Dar es Salaam, you know, with the congestion and the traffic and the pollution, you know? Mm-hmm. You know, and so I was kind of ready for that next experience.
You talked a little bit about Mr. Gazelle, your neighbor, and a lot of the book is about these very kind of complicated relationships that you have with neighbors and, you know, people that you've hired to either help build your home or to work on the compound and things. And there's both a lot of friendship and, you know, a lot of people, you know, helping you to set up and get what you need. But there's also, you know, a little bit of betrayal, too. You know, there's a situation where workers on the compound, a few of them steal your cement.
Mm-hmm.
There's a time where you have one worker who his name, I think, directly translates to I don't care.
Yes.
And he seems to kind of exemplify that in how he cares for the animals or lack thereof, right?
Right.
Is this sort of complicated relationship really common in Tanzania just because, you know, people are trying to make ends meet?
Yes, I think so. And it was really complicated for us because a lot of these people are family. You know, I mean, if you go really deep, you know, and there's a chapter
relatives.
In the book called It's Complicated because sometimes many people there, they call me aunt, they call me grandmother, and they call me mother. And they do it actually for a reason. You know, they are somehow related because my father-in-law, you know, he had four different wives that not necessarily all at the same time, and he had children from all of them. And then when you think that they had children and they had children and they had children and the way it works there, Sajali is actually, I'm his grandmother in the African family there, you know. So Sadie is very good at setting the boundaries and teaching me how to set the boundaries. You know, I see him sometimes. He says, you know, I know that this is farming time. And right now they don't have food, so let me call the store in the next village and have them deliver some rice and beans to my sister. And he'll just do this out the clear blue sky, and then we send money to the phone to that store owner. But in the meantime, one of those sisters' husband was involved in stealing our cement, right? So for me, sometimes I sit, Sadie, I don't know how you could talk to these people, you know? I mean, someone who betrayed us to that, you know, who stole from us. But we live among them, and some of them are family. And then I try to think, they are so, they're very poor. You know, I mean, Tanzania, I say, is Africa is a rich continent. Tanzania is a rich country. You know, so that whole image of poor people, yes, you have a very young population that is undereducated. And Tanzania, 75% of the people live in rural areas. So it's very hard to bring services to all those people. When I say it's rich, right, because you have mining, you have tourism, we have gas now, you have a port, you have fishing. So we are hopeful that if you can get the right people in charge, you can change the life of the people. That's the challenge. But yes, it's very, very complicated. And, you know, I think that I talk a lot about that in the book because I was fascinated by the relationship. And Sadie and I talked about those relationships all the time and watching how Sadie managed them. You know, how, you know, many of these people still we've depended on. Like our neighbor, Mr. Gazelle, there's three different names for him in the book. His Mwenda, Mr. Gazelle, because he knows how to, he's an expert at trapping gazelle, and he's also called Bangi. And Bangi translates actually to marijuana. This is swallow probably right, for marijuana.
He because, smokes.
Yeah. No, uncle, I don't smoke, you know. Okay, you know. But, you know, where we live, it would be difficult to live also without the people around us. You know, example, just 2 weeks ago, we had a python finish off our chickens. Okay, we've had at least five pythons that I know of that we've had encounters with, but normally they're after livestock. You know, they're not after people, and if that's any comfort. My friends tell me, you're scaring us, we'll never come visit you. You know, but you know, for me, I've learned that, you know, animals, they're after a certain thing. They're not after people usually. So you call someone to help you do this, you know? I wouldn't want Sadie to go after the python himself, but he is an incredible manager and supervisor of it. No, do this, step back, grab that, do this. And he has the logic. He told me with, for instance, a green mamba or a black mamba, these are very venomous snakes in our environment. He said, don't hit it with the machete. Use the slingshot because they can follow the line up your arm. You know, and actually,
they're that quick.
Yeah, so a slingshot, and we've killed a few with slingshot. And believe me, there's that mixed feeling of when you have to, I say, neutralize an animal because nature and man clash, right? I always say I'm in their environment. And Jomé doesn't have the deforestation problem of other areas. It still has very dense forest. And that's why I try to explain to people, you know, in a way, maybe that's the beauty of Jomé, is even though sometimes we have encounters with these animals, you know, it's their land, you know, and you could think, you know, we built the house there. So once in a while, we clash with them. And it is kind of a sad thing when you have to eliminate them, but they are very dangerous, like the python. You know, we had a python kill two goats. At night, it went in the banda, like the goat house, strangled a pregnant mother goat, and was in the middle of swallowing one of her twins. You know, so what do? You can't say, oh, you know, just leave it. No, they're very, very dangerous, and now they've moved into your territory.
Right, right. That was a really sad part of the book for me, actually. The goat, the other twin, you know, laying with his dying mother, and you know, things like that.
We had a leopard a month ago. Now I think it's been, who killed one of the characters in the book. Are my two dogs, who are guard dogs. You know, and G-Way was the one who, before we hit the brick fence, was the digger and who went out, went to the beach, stole the fisherman's clothes, would bring him inside the compound, you know. And one night, just a month ago, in the middle of the night, Sadie's a hard sleeper, so it surprised me, that instinct. I was really surprised. He jumped up, grabbed a rifle that he sleeps with, right, went to the window, flashed the light, and said, "I only see one dog," right? And for me, I'm thinking, oh, you know, I wonder what it is. You know, he knew immediately that it was a man or a leopard by the sound, you know, and he, to protect me, he went outside and told me to lock the door, right? And I'm like, but stand by the door in case I have to come in quickly, right? And then he said, "There's only one dog." How can there be only one dog inside a compound that has a 6-foot-tall brick wall?
And the dog that can jump over that wall.
Yeah, and so you're like thinking, "Oh, what happened?" So he called our two helpers that live on a compound, and they came, and one of them found G-Way in that tall grass. So we don't cut our grass much because, during dusty time and dry season, then it's too dusty. So sometimes you cut it, you know, but you don't want to cut it really short because then when the rain goes away, it's going to get too dusty. So, you know, it turned out 100% it was a leopard, and the leopard was fairly large. And it's, to me, to this day, that part, even after 5 years, thinking, getting kind of, you know, a little lackadaisical and comfort in your environment, I'm thinking, oh, a leopard jumped inside the compound, you know? And if you talk to people, they're calm. They say, oh, yes, 2 days ago, we saw leopard tracks there. Even one time with one of the pythons, the longest one we found, which was 13 feet before the brick wall, even, Sajali, and I think maybe the story's in the book, Sajali said, oh, yeah, I saw the tracking there. And it was fairly close to the house. He never said anything. And Sadie, when he saw the python, he didn't call Sajali. Sajali, I don't care. He just said, I knew he couldn't help. And then his nephew came from another village to help with a job. And they were able, in about 30 minutes, maybe almost an hour, they burnt the python out. They started a fire. And there's his nephew saying, all I need is the head. All I need is a head, and they had a machete, you know, and they were able to finish that because they're very dangerous, very, very dangerous, you know, the python in the area. But most of the time, they don't come close to you. So these are still rare events when you think that I've been there for 6 years, you know, but you have to use your common sense. These are predators. Mm-hmm. You know, they're hungry. They're looking for something, you know, and if you know their behavior, then, you know, you're fine. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but... you know, getting back to those relationships and things like that, part of it, there's a part in the book where you talk about, you know, when the colonists came in to those areas in Africa and, you know, back then, you know, and still somewhat today, Africans were more like, well, this is all the land that we share.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not, this is my land and this is my neighbor's land kind of thing. But, you know, do you think that that kind of sort of communal idea is sometimes leads to things like, you know, well, neighbor kid might come over and steal a little bit of water because, you know, this is our land.
Mm-hmm. That's very interesting because I can remember that one of the global health, before I even went to Tanzania, one of the other global health fellows who served in a different country, in a country in West Africa, told me, if you leave something unattended, the feeling was it's you don't care about it, you know. But I still don't give people a pass on that. the cement was definitely our cement. It was there, and people were opportunist. You know, we traveled for a month, and the cement they sold, we found out, for maybe one quarter of the price that we paid for it. You know, and we had to replace that. And we know the people involved, and some of it was family, but people didn't want to tell us everything. And part of it was the builders, the apprentice builders who were living there for 5 months. You know, we built like a grass, they were living in a grass hut there during that construction. So I still have a lot of mixed feelings about that, because sometimes I say, oh, people are really so poor, you know, and they think we have. They think the money comes. They don't know where the money comes from. They just know Sadie's married to an American. He's married to a foreigner, and they have so, so much more. You have to picture that we're the only car for kilometers around. And when we first moved there, people didn't even have motorcycles. Now, at least in our village, many, many people have motorcycles. When I say many, many, several of the boys, you know, were able to somehow get a motorcycle and they use it like for taxi service.
Many, many more than what there were before.
Yeah, because before it was like zero. You know, they only had bicycles. You know, and that was considered, that's a really big item for people, are bicycles. And in my village, they still carry their water several kilometers from this hole that you may say is a well, you know, for their water supply. And a bicycle is a very, very important item in that environment. So, you know, they see you have so, so much more. So it's such a big difference. You know, even now, people now are just beginning to get solar. Solar just for lights. You know, now there's these kits you can buy that are probably less than $100, where you get a panel and four bulbs. And this is really a life-changing thing for people. Now, this solar energy and making it affordable for people in very rural areas. You know, so that's what I mean. Life is changing a little bit. People now have more of those corrugated metal sheet for their roofs. Well, when I first went there, they only had grass for their roof, you know, thatch roofed. You know, so slowly, slowly, people are seeing that they want something different. They save up. Instead of growing just food because they're subsistence farmers for themselves, now during farming season now, they are growing some cash crops like sesame. But if they make the wrong decision, they can go hungry. They still have to be able to manage that. You know, in older days, all the food and the only thing you farm was for your own consumption. Now people want other things, right? They want to pay school fees for their children. Maybe they want to get solar, you know. So to do this, they have to grow something like sesame, or maybe they have cashew trees.
Yeah, some kind of cash crop.
Yeah. So that is changing the lifestyle a little bit of people in the village slowly. And also some villages now have power who didn't have power before. The government is trying to bring power to all rural areas. So, so things are changing. But, yeah, they see it. I try to understand the differences. And sometimes I say, whoa, they're just so poor. We had somebody from here who came to our house, and they had a camera. And they went into the beach and they dropped, when their children went into the ocean, the wife dropped the camera. So people who make their living off the ocean walked past. When she came back, the camera was gone. Our neighbor, they know it's from her. They know it's one of our guests. Do you think anybody would bring it to us? Maybe some people would. But in this particular case, she took it thinking she can get money from it. And even our neighbor, Mr. Gizell, said he knew who had it. So we knew the whole history of this camera. Number one, they didn't have the accessories to make it work. But first he tried to sell it in Machinga, a bigger village. Then he tried to take it to Lindy Town. Then they gave it to another relative who took it to Dar es Salaam. We're hearing all these rumors, but it still angers me, you know, that that happened. But then I understand, oh, these people think that we have everything and that we don't miss it.
Right. And that it's unlimited.
Yes.
Right?
Uh-huh. Yeah. You know, even one time my husband was planting coconuts to grow coconut trees. The farm used to have a lot of coconut trees. When he came back, he was very disappointed. The coconut trees were gone. You know, I don't know if it's because they had a disease, because of the weather, or because fishermen, they do fires to burn the thatch,
mm-hmm.
you know, the brush. So anyway, they were digging a coconut seed, which is like a coconut itself, in the ground. They were being taken. You would find the coconut gone. Now, this is a very simple thing. So one of my friends, when I told her that story, she says, why don't you just put a sign? You don't have to steal the coconuts. Just come to the door and we'll give you one. You know, and I said, yeah. You know, and sometimes we do get visitors. This is what we were talking about, the boundaries, the complicated relationship. People do come who don't even know us with their problems. So Sadie is the one that has to manage this. You know, and then he'll come inside and says, I gave them, you know, maybe the equivalent of $3. Oh, I couldn't give them money, so I told them to go to the store, and I'm going to call the store, and I told them they can take 5 kilograms of rice and 2 kilograms of beans. You can't let people starve, you know, but on the other hand, they have to, you still have to set that boundary, because our resources are not unlimited. They are limited.
Mm-hmm. You know, and talking about, you know, that kind of charitable nature, let's talk a little bit about the LIFT Foundation, the Lindy Islamic Foundation of Tanzania, or LIFT mm-hmm. for short. You know, what do you guys do?
Okay, so we work in a couple of different sectors. When I first founded LIFT, and let me just say it was inspired because of the generosity of friends primarily from this community in Kalamazoo. You know, and Sadie and I sat around and said, gee whiz, you know, I mean, what happens if I'm not here anymore? Why does everything have to go through me? Maybe we can build something that's sustainable. And in the meantime, I can use some of these skills because, you know, to maybe transfer some knowledge to build the capacity locally to find new leaders who can continue this after I'm gone.
Right. And by this, we mean, you know, charitable
yes.
gifts toward education, health, and other things.
Right. So let me just, you asked, what do we do? Now, we were founded in 2013. And when I say 2013, we are registered with the government of Tanzania through the Ministry of Home Affairs, which is how it's done for faith-based organizations. When we first started, we had 5 programs, health, food security, education. Did I say health already?
You did.
Okay, health, education, food security, water sanitation, and dawah. And dawah is the religious part. You know, like, oh, we want to build a mosque. We have an annual Quran reading contest, like that. Okay. Well, you know, I'm winging it, you know, from, you know, my knowledge working at Pfizer. You know, how this is going to work, and that, and it's a volunteer organization. So I'm not shy about sometimes, you know, we try to reorganize. And we have a board of directors, and we have a management team. But we've reorganized a couple times to downsize. And believe me, I'm familiar with downsizing after being in corporate America for 29 years. And reorganize and realign, you know, when to make it more efficient. You know, it began to be too many committees to manage, and especially for volunteers who this is just, they have very limited time to spend on the organization. Right now we have 2 major programs, education. We're trying to build an early child development center in a village, and we have the health committee. But some of these other things that come up still fall under those committees. example, you know, if we have a need, let's say, to build a mosque for the Quran context that falls under education now instead of having its own committee, the water sanitation can fall under health. So we've done cervical cancer screening for 2 years. Like I said, we're trying to build our early child development center. And we get a lot of applications for educational assistance. So I look at the budget and we decide to approve it and not to help pay someone's school fees. We've done food distribution, like to try to fill the gap between, you know, sometimes you hear, oh, this village has a real problem. One time there was a village, very remote village, no access by even motorcycle, that we heard about that all their farms was stampeded by elephants.
Oh, wow.
Right? And they were starving. Okay, so the day we went to deliver food that we called, they met us at the road at a warehouse, and they said that they would carry it in the food themselves. When we went there, there were government people there also who went to see how serious the situation was. There are times when the government doesn't have any budget. One time we saw the district commissioner begging shop owners for food for a fire that had happened to a family where they lost everything. And, you know, people store all their food for the year in their house, you know, because it's dry food, like rice and flour. And so we gave money and bought that for them. So that's emergency. So, but my desire is to look for things that's going to change, make a change in people's life. You have the emergency, right? People are hungry right now. Right. But then that's why I really hope that we can be successful with this early child development center, because that maybe even, you know, when I'm 6 feet under, at least maybe that generation can really make a real change in their life. Because really, what's the purpose? To eradicate poverty. Right. Health. Another example, I think people need education. Malaria. People still dying from malaria, people still dying from TBs, people, and malaria, it's the medicine is cheap, it's available, but people don't get care. I get malaria every year. I just had malaria a month ago, actually. No, maybe a week before I traveled here. The point is, when I get the symptom, I know, let me get tested, let me get on a dose right away. People in rural areas, they delay to make the decision to go. Another point is they go to local traditional healers rather than going to what we would say more Western type medicine, you know. Maybe some of these treatments work well, but to me, I don't mess with things like malaria and TB. You know, I want the antibiotics. I want the, you know, the anti-malarias. You know, so people die. The life expectancy in Tanzania still isn't 60. It's still in the 50s.
Right. I think you said 56 or something
somewhere,
like that.
Yeah, it depends on where you look. But still, it's, you know, you don't see over 60. Right. Maternal mortality is still very high. Now, Lyft is very small and has a very small budget. And like I said, we work on our volunteer members. And we work with volunteer members. You know, so it's small steps. Sometimes we're driven by the we are driven by the donors, right? If you go to the Linda Islamic Foundation website, you know, people donate for the program they want. Like I have a friend that says, I care about water. Another friend says, I care about this. Someone may say, oh, I want to build a mosque. You know, so the money has to go for that. I can't put that to the early child development center. Right?
Right, right.
So I would hope to, like, I would like to use interns. I would like to, to me, the Early Child Development Center is our biggest, riskiest project. And I say risky because it's really big, and how is it going to be sustainable? You know, but it can make the biggest impact.
You know, you were talking a little bit earlier about how things have changed mm-hmm. in Tanzania. You know, are there certain areas that Lyft is working on that you've seen, you know, some good change in those, you know, like in health or education or anything like that?
Okay, so for health, as an example, we had two cervical cancer screening clinics. And a few nurses were trained in a low, inexpensive screening method, just using vinegar. You can use vinegar and you can see abnormal cells. Now, after that, you would have to go to the next step, but just from that screening, you can identify the high-risk patients who then can get referred to Dar es Salaam, or even at the regional hospital in Lindi. They have the ability to do the freezing of the cells, but for a serious case, they would transfer you. I'm not keeping statistics on that, and we really don't have funding to continue something like that, but I'm encouraged by the fact that we used the same nurses for the two clinics with the help of, we had a doctor from the U.S. come, and do the training and to participate in those clinics. One of the clinics we actually did at the agricultural festival. So we set up tents, to do that and screened women. We also, on the health, we give health cards, depending on funding, to most vulnerable children. Most vulnerable children are identified by, the social welfare ministry, so they can get free medicine, free testing. So, but the card is good for 1 year only, but you can have, if that child has that, and you can even add family members to it, one card is probably, if I do the conversion, about $4. And that $4, that child then can go to a clinic for the whole year. And believe me, children, they get malaria almost every year. I mean, this is a really malaria endemic, area. But there's still, I think, a long way to go for, educating people. But I'm happy that the government also has programs that are concentrating on the things that we want to. And the government does look to partner with the private sector. And so, I would say, we're private sector, and we can't do it alone. Whenever we have a clinic, we engage the, the government, the Ministry of Health, and so on. I was really happy. We also try to work with bigger foundations, like Aga Khan Foundation is a very big foundation, and they actually did the pap smear pathological testing. There isn't a pathologist in Lindi at all. So even those patients that were high risk, if we even did a pap smear, we had to take the slides all the way to Dar es Salaam and have them, read them. As far as education is concerned, we still have a long way to go. Mm-hmm. And again, like I said, you have to partner with the government. Part of the challenges are, like I mentioned before, it's very rural. So to get teachers to live in those austere conditions, because there's primary schools in the villages, that's one issue. Many of them don't have running water, do not have electricity, so you can imagine the challenges there. The primary school education is in Swahili. Secondary is in English. So you can imagine the children are not very well prepared when they get to secondary school unless they've had, a private education. So that's why I really want to do the early child development, to bring other skills to make them better prepared so they can pass in secondary school.
Right, because it's hard to learn a language, later on in life. Right. You get, right?
Yeah, I mean, they have an English class, in the primary school, but the education curricula is in Swahili. Then now all of a sudden you pass, and now you're in secondary school.
And it's all in English.
And it's all in English. So all they do is memorize to pass the test. They don't have a good understanding. And part of the challenge is that at the primary school level, you really don't have teachers that are very qualified to teach the English at the primary school level. And one of the things that one of my coworkers did that I worked with that Pfizer. When I told him that's challenging, this was even before Lyft, I said, they don't have English books, but they need English. That one time, the teachers would come to us in Jome, from the teachers from our primary school in our village, would come with a list of things they need, even things from red pens. The teachers. We don't have any English books. We don't have any social studies. We don't have this. We need the teachers for this. The teacher's guidebook for this. So one year, I mentioned this, and my friend said, I'll buy English textbooks for all the students. And the thing that was very interesting about that, the headmaster or principal, he said, well, the standard is 2-to-1. It doesn't have to be one for each child. Right? And I was like, well, no, they're each getting one. Okay. So we bought the books. And, oh, one thing about Tanzania, they like lots of ceremonial things. Sometimes it really surprises me. And because I have the title of founder and Dr. Osborne, sometimes when I show up for something, like giving out the health cards, I was like, okay, doctor, stand here. Stand. Let's take pictures. And I'm like, oh, my goodness, they make a big deal out of such a little thing. But it was a big deal. You know, the English books, and we gave them to the students, and that class was, I think the next year, my village had the most kids that ever passed the exam. You have an exam that you have to pass to go to the next level. If you fail, you're done, or you have to take the private route, and very few people have that. That's the challenge there. And now, 2 years ago was the first time anyone from my village finished, not passed, finished secondary school. Wow. Just 2 years ago, that class. And we promised them, my husband and I personally promised them, that if they, whether they fail or pass, we would take them to the technical school and pay for that. Because the technical school there is very inexpensive, and you can even sometimes get boarding. But anyway, so these four, so out of all that, 18 children from that class a couple years ago, well, I would say 4 or 5 years ago, when we first went there and we gave the books, 18 children passed the primary school, unprecedented for my village. Of those 18, only 4 finished secondary. They all failed the test still. And no girls. So the challenge is still very huge. You know, there's just so much need, you know, especially when you talk about rural, you know, areas like where I live.
Right. But it, at least it sounds like there's, you know, like something is happening.
Yes.
That's good to hear.
Mm-hmm.
Dr. Alexandria Osborne will talk about her book, The Black Mzungu, Monday at Kalamazoo's Eastwood Library at 6 p.m. Alexandria, thank you so much.
Okay, thank you.